Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is the California Dream Weekly Roundup for July 24th, 2021. So before I start, I want to thank Hal Lohr and Shankar Singham of Red Star Report for being our first guests last week. If you didn't catch the interview, it's the episode immediately preceding this, whether you're listening to this on one of the podcast platforms or at the YouTube channel. So please go check out the interview and check out their show at redstarreport.com. So today is July 24th, and that means that today is the March for Medicare for All. This is a set of coordinated rallies taking place in over 60 American cities to demand the federal government take action on healthcare, that we move beyond our for-profit, employer-based health insurance system to some form of single-payer or nationalized health system that is free at point of care. Now, this is kind of a difficult topic for me to talk about without letting my emotions get the better of me, because this is an issue that really affects me personally. Both my wife and I have chronic medical conditions that require continual medical appointments, laboratory tests, medication refills, occasional surgeries, and really a near constant interaction with both doctors and hospitals, as well as, of course, the insurance company and payment systems. So we know firsthand how monumentally screwed up the American healthcare system is, how inefficient it is, how corrupt and profitable it is, how cruel and barbaric it is. Just to give you one example, and I'm sure there's a lot of Americans who will recognize this type of situation, but about half of our listeners are international, so I'm also mentioning this for them. And this doesn't really involve my wife or myself. This was our second daughter. When she was just a year or two old, she was playing in the front room, and she, she runs around. She's very active, and she bumped into something. She kind of bumped her head or bumped her body against the couch or table or something. And she kind of fell to the floor and immediately stopped breathing. Her eyes rolled behind her into her head and started to change color a little bit. And this was all within about 10 or 15 seconds. And this was the first time this had happened. We didn't know anything about what was going on. So, of course, we did what any parent would do. We immediately called 911. The ambulance came out, and it came out pretty quickly. By the time the ambulance had showed up, she was starting to come to. So she was conscious again and starting to breathe. And we talked to the ambulance personnel, and we agreed to have her sent to the emergency room to be looked at. Again, this had never happened before. We didn't have any idea what was happening, and so we wanted to find out what was going on. And since the ambulance was already there, we said, okay, great. Let's take her to the ER, and we'll meet you over there, and we'll meet with the doctors and see what's going on. Now, it turns out that she had kind of a condition that a lot of infants or toddlers have. I'm not sure I remember the name of it, but it kind of causes this type of thing to happen occasionally, and usually it resolves itself in a minute or two, but neither of us knew about that type of condition. But in any case, we ended up getting a bill for the ambulance ride for about $2,500. Now, keep in mind, I have health insurance through my employer, the community college, and it's really good health insurance. We have pretty much like the second to the top. So not the very best plan you can buy, but kind of like the second best. So it's what most people would call a quote-unquote Cadillac plan. Nevertheless, we got this bill for $2,500. But we tried to, of course, fight this bill because we're like, why should we have to pay $2,500 for an ambulance visit? We have insurance. And it turned out they denied the claim. We ended up having to pay it, $2,500. And the reason given was that the ambulance that was provided was, quote unquote, out of network. So let me get this straight. In the moment when your daughter is laying on the floor, not breathing, their eyes rolled in the back of her head, I'm supposed to do the research to figure out which ambulance I'm going to call that's in network and not out of network so that the insurance will cover it. This is the frickin' insanity of the American healthcare system. I told you this makes, I have to keep my emotions in check. I get really pissed off when I start talking about this stuff. But that's just one thing that has happened. They'll give you an idea of just how insane the American healthcare system is. So I really do appreciate all the time and effort that everyone has put into the activism taking place today. I really do. Having said that, and I'm sure I'm going to piss off a lot of people by saying this, but you're wasting your time. As Shankar said in our interview, America is not so much a country as it is a machine. It's a machine for making profits at the expense of people.
This machine of the United States is a machine. There's nothing that can be done when there's that income, that money that's involved with separating families, detention centers, funding detention centers. That money is too much. And a bunch of activists aren't going to change that, dude.
And that American machine will never allow a system that denies profits to the health insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the hospital industry. It's just that simple. It's never going to happen. Now, I'm not saying that the people who now live in the United States will never get universal health care. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the United States will dissolve or cease to exist before that ever happens. And that's why I'm for California independence, because I understand that Californians trying to get universal health care through Washington, D.C., you're wasting your time. It's never going to happen. And if you think you can do it at the state level, like some California state version of single payer, I've already talked about why that's not a viable solution. Healthcare has to be funded at the level of the currency issuer. So if you want a California state version of single payer or nationalized universal healthcare, then California has to issue its own currency. And that is simply not possible without independence. So I appreciate the effort, but really, Californians, if you think this is the right strategy, I think you're delusional. It's never going to happen. Two other pieces of California-specific news before we get to the really big story I want to talk about last today. California has agreed to pay reparations up to $25,000 to women who were sterilized by the state government, some of them victims of eugenics programs initiated at the start of the 20th century, some of them prisoners who were sterilized as recently as 2010 without their consent. $25,000 doesn't seem like nearly enough to me, but this is certainly a welcome step. So I know in the California independence movement, we often like to brag about how progressive we are, how we're ahead of the curve on important issues, how we've moved past certain debates. It's also important to recognize that California does have a problematic history in many regards, and we shouldn't try to gloss over that or minimize it, especially not in the independence movement. I think what does separate California from the rest of America is that we're able to be honest about our past. we're willing to have these difficult discussions. We're ready to come to terms with some of the wrongs we've committed. We're not in denial about the past. Compare that to the rest of the country, which not only can't deal with its racist history, its colonial and imperialist history, not only is America in denial, it's actively attempting to rewrite history. It's trying to pretend that history never happened. There are efforts underway to rewrite textbooks and prohibit teachers from teaching even the most uncontroversial judgments about history. So I think that is a fundamental difference between California and the rest of the country. Both California and America have a lot of problematic history and a lot of things to come to terms with. But I think we're willing to do that here now. And America really seems to be going in the other direction. The other piece of California-specific news I want to mention, the University of California is raising its tuition yet again, this time for at least 5 years, maybe more. We'll see. So I'm going to quote from an Associated Press article. This was published on July 22nd. Quote, University of California Regents on Thursday approved a multi-year plan to raise tuition and fees at the system's 10 campuses. The proposed increase is the first since 2017 and had been criticized by opponents as a forever hike. University officials say the increase is needed to maintain the quality of the public university system and provide more financial aid to students. The proposal calls for tuition and fees to rise by 2% plus inflation for new undergraduates starting in the 2022-23 academic year. UC officials estimate that will amount to an additional $534, putting tuition and system-wide fees at just over $13,000 a year for in-state students. The estimate does not include additional campus-based fees. Now, this is again an issue that is kind of personal for me. I've been very much involved in all three of the California college systems. So if you're not familiar with how California higher education is set up, there are three systems. There's the University of California system, which has 10 campuses. These are research level universities. Many of them are considered comparable to Ivy League schools. There is also the California State University system. This is more the main undergraduate university system. It's focused much more on teaching, although its professors do research as well. But it is definitely more focused on bachelor's degrees, and a few offer master's degrees, whereas the UC system offers PhD degrees. There is also the California Community College system, which is a system of two-year colleges that are open access. They focus on transfer level classes, so lower division transfer level classes, as well as technical career training and remediation. So I have been a student and an employee at all three systems. I was a student at a community college when I was an undergraduate. I also graduated from Cal State Stanislaus as an undergraduate, a Cal State school. I then went to graduate school at UC Santa Barbara. So I was a student in the University of California system. While I was a graduate student at UC Santa Barbara, I was also employed, as almost everyone in the math department was, as a teaching assistant and teacher. So I taught students at UC Santa Barbara. Then I came back to the Central Valley, and I worked at Cal State Stanislaus as a lecturer, and now I work at Delta College and the community college system. So I've been a student and an instructor or professor at all three systems. Now, this is a big topic. we could get into, because you kind of would have to deal with considering each system separately. They're different systems, and there's different aspects to them. But this is concerning the UC. So I looked up some information about University of California funding, and I found a paper called Approaching a Tipping Point, a History and Prospectus of Funding for the University of California. This was published in August of 2018, so almost 3 years ago. It's pretty recent. And they go over a lot of different aspects of the funding of the University of California system. And if you're interested in, you know, when did this increase in tuition and fees really take off? This really happened during, I would say, the 90s and the 2000s. And this is at both the UC system and the California State University system. It's a little difficult to explain to students today, especially at the UC and CSU system, how inexpensive higher education was in California just 25 or 30 years ago. Just to give you an example, I started at Cal State Stanislaus in fall of 1991. That was my first semester as a student. And the tuition for one semester was less than $450. So if you put together books and other fees, you know, which at the time hadn't gotten so much out of control, the total for tuition and books and fees and everything for the entire academic year was around $1,000, maybe a little bit more, but not much. That meant that I did go through 5 years of undergraduate education working part-time. I worked about 30 hours a week. I got, you know, a couple of modest scholarships, but I basically graduated from undergraduate without a penny of student debt. I didn't have any student debt when I graduated. And that was only possible because the tuition at that time was still pretty inexpensive. The tuition at the CSU system since then has increased tenfold. So it's about 10 times as expensive now. Even accounting for inflation, it's 5 times as expensive. So that means the amount that you would have to pay today to go to school for 1 year at a CSU school would basically pay for your entire undergraduate education, the time that I was a student. So that gives you just an idea of how much the costs have increased. Now, getting to this this paper where they talk about what is the source of this increase in tuition and fees. Well, it really happened at various times when the economy did not do so well. So this happened during the dot-com bubble when we had the crash. This was around 1999, 2000, if you remember that. And then, of course, in 2008, we had the global financial crisis, and that is when the tuition and fees really got out of control because there was major fiscal issues with the state budget, and one of the ways that they decided to close the gap was to just increase tuition. So what this means is the reason that students are going into debt so much, it's not because they're lazy. It's not because they don't have discipline. It's not because you know, they have to pull themselves up by the bootstrap. No, the reason they have to pay so much and the reason they're in so much debt is because the burden of funding the education has literally been transferred from the state to the students and their families. It's as simple as that. I mean, this is in the data. You can go and read the paper. It's clear as day there. It's just the funding, almost all of it was by in 1960 or 1970, almost all of it was funded by the state. And now it's split about 50-50 between the state and the students. So where the students paid almost nothing, now they're burdened with about half of the cost. Now, why do I bring this up? besides the fact that it's just something that's important going on in California. Again, what was the source of these increases? The state of California funds higher education. State of California is a currency user. It has to balance its budget, or it has to tax and borrow to pay for things. That means when the economy goes south, when it has less revenue, when it's having trouble with its budget, it has to figure these things out. It has to increase tuition on students. It has to come up with some way of resolving these budget issues. If California was independent, it wouldn't have these types of financial budget constraints. It would be able to run deficits. It would be able to spend on higher education without worrying about how you're going to pay for it. We would just decide education is important. It's something that's important. Whether the economy's doing well, whether the economy's not doing well, doesn't matter. This is just something we're going to do. And if the economy's not that great, so what? We're still going to fund it, and we're not going to put that burden on the students and their families. And this is something, again, I keep coming back to over and over again. We were talking about healthcare. I talked about this. And now I'm talking about it with education. California has to be independent so that it can fund these important programs without having this fiscal constraint that comes from being a user of the US dollar. It's as simple as that. And this is just one more instance of that particular dynamic playing out. Finally, there was a survey released this past week that I want to talk about. So Brightline Watch is an organization founded in 2016 by political scientists from several American universities. They bill themselves as, quote, an initiative to monitor democratic practices, their resilience, and potential threats, unquote. That's where the name Brightline comes in, as in a bright line or threshold whose violation signifies a danger to democratic institutions and norms. On their website, they display a tagline: one of the greatest threats to democracy is the idea that it is unassailable. I think that's a great quote. So this is a highly respected group of professionals. One of their major projects is a series of public and expert survey reports, which they've been conducting in what they call waves since February of 2017. They usually release one of these waves roughly every 3 months, give or take. The most recent wave was Wave 15, which was conducted last month, June of 2021. So this is the Wave 15 Public and Expert Survey Report. And that's the report I want to talk about. In this survey, they asked respondents about many different issues, events, and proposals. And I would really encourage you to take the time to read the entire report, because it's packed with a lot of interesting information and conclusions. But there are two items I really want to focus on. The first is something they call, quote, assessments of likelihoods and threats, unquote. So this survey asked experts in political science to assess the consequences and relative seriousness of the various actions that Republicans are taking as we approach the midterms and 2024 presidential election. Everything from voter suppression tactics, such as voter ID laws and restriction of voting by mail, to legislative strategies, such as empowering state election boards to suspend election officials. And what I thought was interesting is that a lot of attention is being paid to the former type of threats. The voter suppression moves like banning water and food to voters waiting in line, voter ID requirements, eliminating early voting. And while certainly these tactics were not endorsed by the experts, the vast majority of them did not consider these a serious or grave threat. And just to be clear, those are their words, not mine. They were asked to rank each threat according to six choices. In ascending threat level, the choices were benefit, will not affect, little threat, moderate threat, serious threat, and grave threat. And most of the experts actually concluded that the voter suppression tactics will have little effect on the election outcome, the notable exception being the restriction of voting by mail. That was considered to be at least a moderate threat by about 70% of experts. However, they had a very different opinion on the two legislative strategies given. These would be empowering state election boards to suspend election officials and increasing state legislative control of state election boards. These were ranked as serious or grave threats by large majorities of the experts. Quoting from the report, quote, "The experts perceive the greatest danger from efforts to change electoral administration. Even more than barriers to voting, reforms to increase political control over election boards and local officials are regarded as presenting grave or serious threats to democracy by 58% and 61% of the experts, respectively. Over three-quarters of experts also view restrictions on eligibility to vote by mail and the distribution of mail ballots as posing a threat to democracy, though relatively fewer believe that such provisions would present a serious or grave threat." Then that was still 42%. So there are two reasons I want to point this out. The first is that this is not being discussed much in the media, at least not in comparison to the more commonly known voter suppression tactics. This is something that seems to be largely flying under the radar. But there's another cause for concern here. That is that the election reform bills currently in Congress, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Act, primarily focus on the former type of voter suppression tactics and would do little, if anything, to address these more serious state legislative power grabs. In other words, even if somehow both of these bills went into law, the most serious threats to American democracy would remain largely unaddressed by Congress. Go figure. The other item I want to point out from this report is a question that was asked about secession from the United States. Again, quoting the report, quote, "President Biden made it a signature goal to reunite a country scarred by partisan and regional divides. Our surveys seek to assess whether the animus that characterized the Trump era persists. We therefore repeated a question from our January-February 2021 survey, asking respondents in our public sample about their support for breaking up the United States. As in last winter's survey, we asked respondents the following." Quote, so this is the question quoted within the report. "Would you support or oppose your state," that's in brackets, "seceding from the United States to join a new union with," and then in brackets, "list of states in the new union," unquote. So let me explain kind of what's going on here. What they've done is they've taken the United States and they've broken them up into five geographic regions. The first is the Pacific. That's California, Washington, Oregon, Hawaii, and Alaska. There's Mountain, which includes Nevada, Arizona, Idaho, Montana, some of the other mountain states. The South, which is, you know, pretty much the entire South, all the way from Texas up to Virginia, North Carolina. The Heartland, what most people would call the Midwest, Rust Belt. And then the Northeast, which is New England, all the way down to, you know, Maryland, Delaware, D.C. So they've broken the country into these five geographic regions, and then they ask people in whatever state they're in, they say, would you support or oppose your state seceding from the United States to join a new union with, and then they list the states. So for instance, if you're in California, then you would have received the question, would you support or oppose California seceding from the United States to join a new union with Washington, Oregon, Hawaii, and Alaska? If you lived in Wyoming, then your question would say, would you suppose or support Wyoming seceding from the United States to join a new union with Idaho, Montana, Utah, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico? So as far as a question trying to gauge support for secession in the country, I suppose this is a good question. There are some problematic aspects to it. The fact that they're kind of lumping a bunch of states together, I think that may affect how people answer it. I'm not quite sure why they include Alaska in the Pacific. It's not really connected to us, and it's ideologically very different from the other four states. Nevertheless, I think this is a good question as giving a rough guide or a rough gauge of the level of support in the country, especially given the fact that they're doing this over consecutive surveys. So whatever problems there may be with the wording or the interpretation of it, it's identical from one survey to the next, so you can see what it is in comparison to what it was before, and you can maybe gauge whether there's increasing or decreasing support across time. Now, the results from this survey, they admit in the report that they were surprised by the results. I'm not too surprised, but they said they were surprised. What they found was that support for secession has increased dramatically over the past 6 months, just since January, February, and it is higher across all regions of the country, not just in the South, not just in the West, although the biggest gains were among Republicans in the southern states and among West Coast Democrats. So again, quoting from the report, yet rather than support for secession diminishing over the past 6 months, as we expected, it rose in every region and among nearly every partisan group. The jump is most dramatic where support was already highest and has the greatest historical precedent among Republicans in the South, where secession support leapt from 50% in January, February to 66% in June. So two-thirds of Republicans in southern states support secession from the United States. Continuing, quote, support among Republicans in the mountain region increased as well by 7 points, from 36% to 43%. Among Democrats in the West, a near majority of 47%, up 6 points, support a schism, as do 39%, up 5 points in the Northeast, unquote. Now, a couple things to point out here. 47% of Democrats in the West, that's nearly half. That is a lot. This indicates that support for secession or support for independence or regional unions, however you want to frame this, this is not a minority position. This is not a minority sentiment. This is a widespread idea. Even if you count everyone in the Western states, not just Democrats, but everybody, it's 39% overall. Now, this is in line with a previous survey that a lot of people in the California independence movement will quote often. There was a Reuters Ipsos survey in early 2017 that found 32% support for secession among California residents. So already, we have a number overall, which was 39%, which is higher than that 32% found 4 years ago. And if you count Democrats only, that jumps to 47%. So I think that's pretty remarkable. And the main takeaway for me from this, just besides the size of the numbers, is this has happened in the past 6 months. This has happened after Biden was inaugurated. This has happened after we're supposed to have the president that's supposed to be uniting the country. And yet we see, even with a Democrat as president, even with Democratic control of the Congress, of the House and the Senate, support for secession or independence, however you want to put it, is still increasing in California, is still increasing in the Western states. And that indicates that this goes beyond just a single presidential administration. Often these discussions about secession are framed in terms of sour grapes about an election result. When Republican wins the presidency, you know, there's a big support for this kind of idea among Democrats and people on the left of the political spectrum because they're not happy with the result, right? And when a Democrat wins the presidency, then this is a big topic among the southern states and among Republicans because they're not happy with the result. And what this is showing really is that this is more than just sour grapes. It's more than just a reaction to an election result. If this were really the case, then what you should expect is when Biden won the presidency, you should expect that support for independence or secession in California would decrease, right? Because we won the election. That didn't happen. It increased. So this is not about one particular president. It's not about one particular administration. This is an ongoing move that's happening. And that's what I really take away from these numbers, is that this increasing division in the country, it's really beyond the control of any one party or any one administration to try and address or solve. It's really out of their control. This is based on a lot more fundamental, structural, and cultural issues going on. And regardless of who's in office, it's going to continue. Okay, that's it for me for today. Have a good rest of your week, and I'll talk to you again next week.